thought about asking y'all a personal question. But I'm going to phrase it a little more delicately. So be ready for this. Do you know your IQ? You notice I didn't say, what is your IQ? I just want to ask if you know your IQ. As to whether you are associated with those up here or those down here. Or somewhere in between. And does it matter? Does it matter what your IQ is? Now, you know what IQ means. It stands for intelligence quotient. It generally is has to do with a score that you get on a test that rates your cognitive ability as compared with the general population. And these IQ tests are standardized on a scale with 100 as the median score. And on most tests, a score between 90 and 110, or the median plus or minus 10, indicates average intelligence. And most of us would like to at least get within that framework if we could. You'll have to do some work to find out where you come in that. Now, a score above 130 indicates exceptional intelligence, and a score below 70 may indicate mental retardation. So there's a little bit of pressure to try to fit within that scale. Now, these tests generally measure your ability to solve problems and understand concepts. And they include reasoning ability, problem-solving ability, the ability to perceive relationships between things, and the ability to store and retrieve information. Now, some of us, as we get older, the ability to store and retrieve information becomes more problematic. And I don't know if this is encouraging or not, but from what I read, adult IQ scores don't significantly increase over time. Although a stimulating environment may boost some cognitive ability, but only temporarily. That means you have to keep at it. Keep stimulating the mind. So your IQ score is relatively stable no matter what education you acquire. Well, that doesn't mean you can't increase your intelligence. IQ tests are only one imperfect method of measuring certain aspects of intellectual ability, and this, is, I think, is helpful to keep in mind. A lot of critics point out that IQ tests don't measure creativity, social skills, wisdom, acquired abilities, or a host of other things that we consider aspects of intelligence. So the value of IQ tests is limited. But they do measure general cognitive ability and have proven, at least over time, to be a fairly accurate indicator of intellectual potential generally associated with success in life, being able to function well. So how would you evaluate your own IQ? Are you happy with it? Do you wish you could start over and get a different level of scale somewhere along the way? So that's all having to do with IQ. Now, what about your CQ? And you have a look on your face as if to ask, what on earth is a CQ? If you had done better on the IQ, this... No, I'm just kidding. That was a joke. CQ is your contentment quotient. Your contentment quotient. It's different than the IQ because you can have a really high IQ and have a really low CQ, or vice versa. Of the two, which do you think is more important? IQ or CQ? Probably the CQ, the contentment quotient, is more important. Now, you may not have read about or seen any tests on a CQ because there may not be any such thing. There might be, but I don't know if there is. But would you like to raise your CQ if you could? Now, we had talked about the IQ, and it's like there are some things that, you know, you're just born with, some things that the environment will affect some so that you can improve, but as a whole, it's somewhat static. So if you're, you know, thinking about raising your IQ significantly, don't put too much of your effort into that. Some is good, but not too much. But the CQ, there's more hope for that. You can do something about that. And so if you could raise your CQ, would you? Well, hopefully we can give some thought to that this morning. Now, last week, we talked about obstacles to godliness, and we had looked at 1 Timothy 6, 3 through 5, and we noticed that the word translated godliness is mentioned three times. Well, it's mentioned a couple times in the first part and then again in the second part that we're going to look at today. And we notice that there are some important things to understand and to distinguish regarding godliness. One of the things we need to remember is that godliness does not exist in a vacuum. In other words, there are factors that are part of the equation where godliness needs an environment in which to manifest itself, which brings up the issue, and I think we've talked about this before, of the ascetics from back in the Middle Ages and continuing today, those who go into monasteries and so on, to focus on being godly, and they have no environment in which to be godly. Essentially, they try to eliminate everything. Well, if life were that simple, then what would be the point? So that you need to have some environment in which to live it out. Last week we talked about the relationship between truth and godliness. Truth is foundational to godliness, and the neglect of truth leads to ungodliness, corrupted minds, etc. The lack of truth is an obstacle to godliness. That's a more critical factor. So just a quick review. Understand the relationship between truth and godliness. If anyone teaches otherwise and does not consent to wholesome words, even the words of our Lord Jesus Christ, and to the doctrine which accords with godliness, and so we note the reception of truth is the foundation for godliness, he is proud, knowing nothing, but is obsessed with disputes and arguments over words, which brings us to the rejection of truth as the cause of active agnosticism. I don't know. From which come envy, strife, reviling, evil suspicions, useless wranglings of men of corrupt minds, and destitute of the truth, which leads to the neglect of truth, results in corrupted minds. Useless wranglings of men of corrupt minds and destitute of the truth, who suppose that godliness is a means of gain. That is the critical phrase that is transitional from last week's message to today's message. Those who suppose that godliness is a means of gain. In other words, I am godly in order to get something materially is the emphasis that's communicated. And then the abuse of truth manifests faulty motivation, that is, seeking to get something materially. From such withdraw is the final statement there. The rejection of truth leads to alienation from God in particular and then from believers and so on. So our relation to truth determines our relation to God. Are we rightly related to the truth? Do we have the truth? Because that's critical. So then, understand the relationship between material and godliness. That's the focus that we want to give some thought to today, which relates to the contentment quotient that we were talking about. Now, godliness with contentment is great gain. Not godliness as a means of gain, but godliness with contentment is great gain. There's something to be gained, but it may not be materially. Notice, for we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain that we can carry nothing out. And having food and clothing with these, we shall be content. There is an element of contentment. There is a possibility of contentment. Develop a concern for contentment. Do we have that? We need to think about the fact that the opposite of contentment is covetousness. What is covetousness? I want more. I want something I don't have. I want more. And that is something that the Bible has a lot to say about, the matter of covetousness. It managed to make it into the Big Ten, that is, the Ten Commandments. It's actually in there. Colossians 3:5 says, "Therefore put to death your members which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry." A desire for something that essentially takes the place of God is the idea. Hebrews 13:5 says, "Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have. For he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you." Now, that presents a problem for those of us who like new things. Should we not want new things? And for each of us, it's something different. We all have different things. For some of us, it's the latest electronic gadget because they've now done an upgrade. And so the new one has something I don't have. And if I don't have it and I need it and I've got to have it. Or for some of you, it's a matter of there's a new fashion style out there that I don't have that I need. So it covers all of us, whatever it is. Be content with such things as you have. Really? When? How long? All the time? Everywhere? 2 Peter 2:3 says, "By covetousness they will exploit you with deceptive words. For a long time their judgment has not been idle, and their destruction does not slumber." Talking about false teachers and the reality of judgment coming upon them. And their covetousness will be a problem in that it will be used against you ultimately. Now, we live in a world where covetousness is promoted very, very strongly. And because our society thrives on it, we tend to see it as less of a problem. We tend to see it as normal. Because everything that comes at us in marketing and advertising is to produce an element of discontent and therefore coveting. So that every advertisement, whether it be on television, on the internet, on billboards, on newspapers, everywhere, all the stuff that we have coming at us. And I realize that's how things work. You have to have the material things bought and sold in order for the commerce to work and all that stuff. I understand that, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't do any of those things. I'm just saying we are in the middle of it, and all of that is being exploited to a maximum degree. And so that it is no small task for us to try to avoid the emphasis on covetousness in our society. We are affected by it rather strongly. The accumulation of things does not bring contentment. That is not a profound statement. That is sort of like the obvious. Like, yeah, we all know that. Really? Then why do we keep trying to accumulate things? Or do we? Now, the word contentment means an inner sufficiency that keeps us at peace in spite of outward circumstances. Let me say that again. An inner sufficiency that keeps us at peace in spite of outward circumstances. Contentment is a disposition. It's an attitude. It does not have a direct connection with what we have. It's a matter of having the right mindset in spite of what we have. Can we keep that in balance? Paul uses the same word in Philippians 4:11. He says, "For I have learned in whatsoever state I am, therewith to be content." And you'll notice he said, "I have learned." I have learned. What does that suggest? It may not come naturally to us. We may have to learn to be content. One individual writes, true contentment comes from godliness in the heart, not wealth in the hand. And we need to think about, okay, what's the relationship of wealth to contentment? We'll give that some thought in a moment. A person who depends on material things for peace and assurance will never be satisfied because material things have a way of losing their appeal, losing their value, and sometimes just getting lost. And somebody else has noted, it is the wealthy people, not the poor people, who tend to go to psychiatrists and who are more apt to try to commit suicide because they're not content, because they have problems. You may be familiar with D. Martin Lloyd-Jones. He was a pastor, but he was a physician before he was a pastor. And he made the following comments in an address that he delivered to the Literary and Debating Society at Westminster Chapel on February 6, 1925. And it was shortly before he became a member of the Royal College of Physicians. He says, of course, the fallacy which underlies all these things, and he was speaking of the pursuit of money, says the fallacy which underlies all these things is a very old one. It is that if you are wealthy, you are happy. Quite by accident, it has been my lot to be able to study a large number of wealthy men at close quarters. And then there is an insert of some information relative to that. Let me give you this insert. The British Prime Minister David Lloyd George, Rudyard Kipling, King Edward VII, and many other wealthy and prominent members of the British nobility were patients of his mentor, Dr. Thomas Horder, chief of staff at St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London, to whom Lloyd-Jones was chief clinical assistant. So he had some close proximity there, and it was on these observations of these wealthy men that he was making this observation. Then he says, the conclusion at which I have arrived concerning them has been that they are intensely miserable people, their misery being exceeded only by those who worship wealth and have it not. That is interesting. Everything we are told, every advertising gimmick and emphasis that we see suggests that happiness and contentment come from the things we accumulate. Now, at our house, we have been in a mode to try to de-junk our house because the kids are not there anymore. Some of their stuff still is there, though we're trying to get rid of some of that. But we're trying to de-junk because we figure, you know, we've been here for 16 years, and there are things that have been put places that have not been used in that length of time, and it is likely will not need to be used. Now, I know none of you can identify with this because you don't have anything in your closets that have been accumulating over the years, but it's like, I just want to get rid of some of this junk, de-junk. And part of it was, just recently the city came up with these new baskets that they put out, they're recycling. I thought, aha, there's another way to get rid of more stuff. And I actually have been feeling better the more junk that goes out. Of course, now it's somebody else's problem. But at least it's getting out of my area so that I'm beginning to see walls in the garage again. You know, there's actually something there behind the stuff that had been accumulating. Now, once Phil and Becca get their stuff, we'll have a lot more room, but they're in too small of an apartment at this point. So, I think it's a good thing to look at the stuff that we have and say, what do I really need? Do I need all this stuff? Are there some things that we can get rid of? I mean, you think about our country. You think about the number of places that we have where you can store things. All the storage units, they're everywhere. How much stuff do we have? And what can you do with the stuff that's in a storage unit? It's just sitting there. And in the closets. Oh, man. So anyway, I will be more content when I get rid of more junk. that's another way of looking at it. So another observation is wealth is not lasting. This is also not a brilliant observation. It is just an observation. Our dual nature, that is, that we are material and immaterial beings, suggests that there's a lot of stuff that we have that doesn't really have any long-term significance, because we're not going to be here physically on this earth forever, though we do have a spiritual existence. And so the material is going to disappear, and it will no longer be of value to us. As verse 7 says, "For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out." The old statement that you don't see a hearse pulling a U-Haul, you don't get to bring it with you, and all of that. Funeral coach, I'm sorry, I'm still using that old term. I've been taught better. It's no longer a hearse, it's a funeral coach. So, we did not exist before conception except in God's omniscience, and our physical being decays at death. Our spiritual being departs for the afterlife, to hell or to heaven. Those are the only two options, but that is a reality. And so whatever wealth we amass goes to the government, to our heirs, to charities or the church, wherever we decide to distribute it, if we decide to distribute it. Just a plug there to remember to do something to make sure you're planning on where it's going. Or do your giving while you're living so you're knowing where it's going, I think is the statement that's made. And we always know the question, or the answer to the question, how much did he leave? What is the answer? Everything. You always leave everything. You don't take it with you. You knew that. Yet we don't act like that sometimes, do we? Hard to get that through our thinking and to live it out. That means we should focus more on the critical things in this life and on the afterlife. And then our basic needs are quite simple. Food and clothing, or food and covering, are basic needs, and they are quite necessary, and we need to provide them. And if we lose them, we lose the ability to secure other things. There was a simple living Quaker who was watching his new neighbor move in. And he was watching all the furnishings and expensive toys and things that successful people collect. And the Quaker at some point finally went over to his new neighbor and said, "Neighbor," now you got to realize this was back a few years perhaps, "Neighbor, neighbor, if thou dost need anything, come to see me and I will tell thee how to get along without it." I'm not sure I'm suggesting you try that with your neighbor to see how that goes, but Henry David Thoreau, the naturalist of the 1800s, reminded us that a man is wealthy in proportion to the number of things he can afford to do without. Interesting to think about that. Some suggest that the economic and energy crises that our world faces will probably be used by God to encourage people to simplify their lives, because as some of our resources are depleted, it may impact life. Someone has said, too many of us know the price of everything and the value of nothing. And so we need to, again, have some perspective on dealing with these things. The reality is that we seem to be so glutted with luxuries that we've forgotten to enjoy the necessities. And we can scarcely distinguish them. That's one of the things I have appreciated about the few opportunities I've had to go backpacking, where you have only what you can carry, and you then realize how much you can get along without, and how much you appreciate what you do have when you have it. I mean, when you've been hiking for a good chunk of the day and you have not a lot of any interesting food particularly, but whatever it is wonderful and you really appreciate it. That'd be good for us every now and then to find ourselves in a situation like that. But moving on. Then verse 9 says, "But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and harmful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition." That doesn't sound good. And so we have a contrast between the proper attitude of contentment with its opposite. And so we need to deflect the craving for material. For the material things of this world, how do you deal with that? A covetous heart creates greater vulnerability to sin. The word translated desire is bulimai here. It means desire, wish, and it implies a planning and exercise of the will. And this desire exposes one to temptation and entrapment and unhealthy lusts or a deep desire or longing for something. And it sort of draws us into trouble because we're wanting something. And that want can be a powerful thing. It could be a good thing if it were wanting the right things, or it could be a negative thing if we're wanting the wrong things. And then it talks about foolish and harmful lusts. The word foolish means without understanding or senseless, or it's desires that have no purpose or value. And then the word harmful, and I like the sound of the word, it's blabberos, like blabberous, only blabberos. The emphasis is on the final syllable. It means harmful or hurtful, and the context favors a moral or a spiritual hurt. And that's what describes these kinds of desires that can be problematic. And these are all aspects of covetousness that have serious implications for daily living. A covetous heart brings on future trouble. That's the emphasis of the second part of the last part of the verse here, which drown men in destruction and perdition. Now, a couple of observations. There's a danger of ultimate destruction if one is drawn to materialism instead of to Christ. And there are many who are pulled into that. I mean, you have the philosophical materialists who say that all there is the material world. And, of course, then you immediately remove God from a possibility. So, therefore, you have ultimate destruction that you're headed for. But there's also a danger of temporal trouble. If one were to trust Christ but have a material focus, it can be a preoccupation with the material things of this world, and that's going to affect your spiritual emphasis because you're more focused on the material than you are on the spiritual, and therefore your spiritual condition will suffer and your level of godliness is not going to be increasing, it's going to be decreasing because of your focus on that material. And that's where we are as a society, very much preoccupied with all the stuff and the things around us. How can we balance that? How can we see things as a means toward the end of living for Christ and making a difference in the world for good? That's what we need to aim for. Then, for the love of the final verse here, for the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. Discern the cause of greed. You'll notice it is the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Not money is the root of all evil, as some have sought to try to translate that. There is a danger in misplaced love. What is it that we love? Do we love money and the material, or do we use those things in the right way, the way in which they're intended to be used, as a means to a proper end? And it's not the need for money that is the problem in itself either, though the need for money can be a problem. That's not the real problem. It's always the heart issue, our perspective. If there is a lack of material resources and it's a legitimate need, then there needs to be a means by which that can be dealt with. But that is a slightly different issue. There is an impact on one's faith, on how one lives their faith. What we realize is that time and money will always be two major challenges in life. Don't we talk about that? Time and money? We seem to always be needing both and lacking enough of either. Or at least so we tend to communicate. Time and money, both are necessary and are limited in their supply. But the interesting thing is we all have the same amount of time, don't we? We all have the same amount of time, but we don't all have the same amount of money, although some would advocate for that. There's a term for that. We're not going to go into that. But that would not solve our problem either, because it's your disposition that's the problem, and how you use what you have. An unhealthy preoccupation with money is a form of greed, and it leads to discontent and therefore a lack of trust in God because you're trusting in your material resources. And so do we have the right perspective on time? Do we have the right perspective on money? How much more of either would be enough? Oh, I wish I had more time. So if you had another 5 or 10 minutes in a day, would that help? I wish I had more money. Would another $5 or $10 a week help? You have a different response. Isn't it, as it relates to time, how I use my time? So isn't it a matter of money, how I use my money? Of course, we have different amounts, and therefore that's the problem. But we still have a matter of how we use what we have and our perspective, our view of things is, again, a critical factor. Then there are consequences on one's emotional well-being. Greed, you'll notice the last part here, it says, for which some have strayed from their faith in their greediness, from the faith in their greediness, and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. Greed can diminish our trust in God to trust in money or the material resources, and it is an inordinate preoccupation with the material world. And then we become practical materialists. Greed generally results in unfulfilled expectations. Expectations are a huge problem in life. Do we have proper and realistic expectations? Because it relates to every area of life. I often think about it in terms of a marriage relationship where you have to have the proper expectations, but it applies in a whole lot of other areas as well. Because we'll never be satisfied with enough, or enough will never be sufficient if we don't have the right expectations. So we need to work through those kinds of things. So a preoccupation with the material world takes us away from our focus on our relationship with God, and it limits our piety, our godliness, and our passion for God. And something that we shouldn't be satisfied with is our level of spirituality. We want to increase that, our level of godliness, if you will. That we want to continue, but we tend to be satisfied with that and be unsatisfied with the material things that we deal with. We need to turn that around. Then, some concluding thoughts. Obstacles to godliness vary from person to person and from time to time. They're not always going to be the same. We need to be aware of that and seek to deal with them. We need to make sure that we have a handle on what the truth is, because that's critical to godliness, right foundation. And we need to make sure we have a handle on material, the material world, our preoccupation, our understanding, our dealing with the material things, because that affects us. We need to be aware of the potential hazard, and therefore we need to examine our own hearts. We need to remain focused on the goal. What is the goal? It is not as you've seen perhaps the bumper sticker that says, he who has the most toys wins. I've seen that. That's not true. Focused on the goal. We had talked last time about what do you want to be when you grow up. Part of the goal is to grow up to be mature in Christ and to know Him. That's what we ought to be working toward. Avoid being distracted. There are so many things out there that would distract us and pull us in a wrong direction. Keep focused on the right goal. Be aware of the three greatest or biggest obstacles to godliness: lust, greed, and pride. These manifest themselves in different ways in different people at different times, but we have to deal with them. Lust, greed, and pride. And they are in direct contrast to contentment, generosity, and humility. Contentment, generosity, and humility. That's what God is desiring us to have.